watching Dr. Dobbs Tech Netcast.
As I look around here, I see a lot of young faces, almost too young. I like youth. I always planned to stay young all my life, but I've always been blessed with a face that's younger than my age. So I've always tried to adopt a young attitude to go with my face. It fools some of the people some of the time, but it doesn't fool Mom. I think she knows I'm just a late bloomer. Speaking of procrastination, I'm late for a lot of things, not just for blooming. For instance, I only started writing this talk yesterday. I kid you not, another one of those just-in-time talks. I'll probably finish writing it sometime tomorrow. Lateness is one of my specialties. Someday I'll be dead, and when you refer to me as the late Larry Wall, people will think you're joking. Well, hey, maybe you are joking. I don't know. Speaking of my long-lost youth, I remember sometime way back during the Kennedy administration, my grade school teacher asked us all to calculate how old we'd be in the year 2000. And I got the unfathomable answer of 46. I could imagine being 10, maybe. But 46 is a lot closer to infinity. Anyway, I couldn't imagine being 46. Now I can. As of last month, I'm now officially in my late 40s. Whoopee! Does this mean I can schedule my midlife crisis soon? Besides my birthday, I recently noticed several other things that tell me I'm not so young anymore. The first thing I noticed was that I just took my first child, Heidi, off to college. Believe me, even if you don't notice your kids while you still have them, you'll definitely notice them when they go away. The second thing I noticed is, I forget what. The third thing I noticed is that I want to start reminiscing about my youth. The old people really only have two or three things to say: how good it was back then, how bad it is now, and if you're lucky, how much worse it's going to be in the future. So I'd like to talk about how good things used to be, how bad they are now, and how much worse they're going to be in the future. Actually, I just said that to be funny. I really do think things are getting better, and it's the getting betterness is what I would like to talk about today. Now, let's get some real. Now, some for me, too. We're both happy. Okay. The name of this talk, for the moment, I might change it, is Camelot Number 6, The Once and Future Pearl. Okay. I'm going to do a little bit like Ken did last night and take you through how bad it used to be and how good it's getting on through the future. Hey, its chronological outline is a great way to go. Some of you may recognize some of these slides. In fact, these are probably about 10 years old, some of them. But I thought I put them in more for the historical value. In fact, if you look carefully, you can see all sorts of gritchiness. That's because it used to be an overhead transparency that I scanned. this is the real original. Anyway, back near the dawn of time, this is what Unix looked like. Either you programmed in C or you programmed in Shell. And, of course, those were two different realms, but it was just sort of one or the other. And we had this, dichotomy of our thinking that you had to do one or the other. Now, how it really was back then, one day sort of opened up to me these were not, in fact, opposites, but, you know, I was thinking of sort of an oyster shell opening up here. They were, instead of being opposites, they were two different dimensions in space, which you could graph something like this. And you could consider sed and ok to be sort of warts on the shell. But for those of you in the back who can't read that, the left-hand axis, what C is good at, is called manipulexity. And the horizontal axis is called whipuptitude. With that realization, I realized that there was a big gray area out there. And in biological terms, that's an ecological niche. And so I decided to fill it. So Pearl got hatched. That's kind of why it's egg-shaped there. And from the beginning, it was designed to grow into that space. And Pearl was always designed to be an evolving language. So the reason I'm telling you some of this stuff is because, as some of you know, we've announced Pearl 6 recently, and I'm going to be talking about that later. But one of the very, very, very high-level goals of Pearl 6 is to keep Pearl capable of evolving. Pearl 5 was running up into some limits, and we're going to figure out how to get around those limits. Anyway, there are, you know, here's the two axes of C and shell, and obviously there could be other dimensions too. There could be a Python dimension and a Java dimension, but you know, the same thing applies. You don't want to think in terms of either or. It's really easy for people to get, especially computer scientists for some reason, to get locked into this sort of either or thing. Well, either I use the GPL or I don't. Well, why not use the GPL and some other license? Isn't that right, Ken? And so it wasn't long after this that I invented dual licensing, and I think that actually works pretty well. So there's lots of ways in which we try to avoid falling into the either-or thing. Pearl got its philosophical inputs from four different areas. It's not just from computer science, obviously. Now, from this diagram, you can kind of see that computer scientists tend to not like the idea of art. You know, they'd rather things be more scientific, you know. So computer science is sort of the opposite of art there, maybe, but I don't know that linguistics is the opposite of common sense. Maybe it is. I've been trying to learn Japanese lately, I like Japanese, actually. But, you know, people say Pearl is hard to learn. Nah, Japanese is hard to learn. Anyway, more specifically, some of the inputs that Pearl took from those four languages I mentioned earlier. The bold things are things I borrowed, and the not-so-bold things are things that I specifically left behind. You know, people often think that Pearl is just hodgepodge, everything, including the kitchen sink. But I actually left out a few of the kitchen sinks along the way. And though a few have snuck in, and that's what we'll talk about later. Now, the question is, when you combine things like this, is it good or is it bad? Well, that's a personal judgment. I have my opinion on it. I have a lot of opinions, actually. Some of them you'll notice in the design of Pearl. I don't like dangling syntax. You know, and I think that ordinary people like me actually hate abstraction. Of course, that sort of assumes I'm ordinary, I guess, but I like to think of myself as ordinary. Sort of ordinary, weird, but ordinary. And I believe contradictory things. You know, I believe C is wonderful, and I believe C is awful. And I believe Bach is neither. I think of language as an amoral medium, by which I mean language itself is like an artistic medium. It's like paint. You don't have pretty paints and ugly paints. It's after you arrange them on a canvas, then they get pretty or ugly. Similarly, language is something you use. You can write beautiful poems or ugly flames, or beautiful flames, if you like. I think ugly can be beautiful. I think beautiful can get ugly really quick. I think in particular of Lisp, which is the most beautiful language in the world, and every program written in Lisp is really ugly. I think visual metaphors are more than just poetry. So, you know, I think things that are different ought to look different. I simultaneously, well, this applies to all language designers. You have to simultaneously not care what other people think and care what other people think. And I think that God has free will, which is why he designed us to be creative, and which is why programmers prefer to have more than one way to do it. That gives them choices, and that makes programming fun. Now, lots of people design computer languages and fall into all sorts of traps. We need to start over from scratch. That's almost any academic language that throws out all the existing art and says we're just going to make everyone think entirely different than they ever used to think before. If we put in English phrases, that makes it readable. That's COBOL. Simple languages produce simple solutions. Well, there's lots of simple languages, but actually, simple languages produce complicated solutions because you have to be verbose. If I wanted it fast, I'd write it in C. That was the original reasoning behind making awk run so slow. I thought of a way to do it, so it must be right. That's a very common trap. People just implement the first thing they think of. This is a very high-level language. Who cares about bits? Again, languages like awk. You can do anything you want with NAND gates. That's Turing machines, I guess, or something like that. Users care about elegance. No, they care about getting their job done. For some reason, lots of languages that come out of Europe have this thing about elegance that I just don't quite get, obviously. The specification is good enough. That's Ada. Abstraction equals usability. Maybe that's Lisp or Scheme. Or maybe even ML, I don't know. Let's see. The common core should be as small as possible. That's fourth. Let's make this easy for the computer. That's assembly language. Most programs are designed top-down, Pascal. Text processing doesn't matter, Fortran. People should never have been given free will. Lots of languages. Now, I think that what actually makes a language useful is not the theory involved in it. Theory is good, but if you drive a particular theory into the ground, that just drives people away. So a language is its practicality is inversely proportional to the number of theoretical axes that the language attempts to grind. Don't mind theory, just don't like theoretical axes. That's an interesting chart that I go back and look at every now and then. to remind myself that programming is not a sequential activity. We already saw the fallacy of the either-or thinking. Another fallacy that we often fall into is the sequential notion. Some of you may have heard of, you know, the waterfall chart, which, you know, you talk about doing the specification, and then you go to the design, and then you go to the coding, and then you do the testing, and so on and so on. But in actual fact, it's more of a chaotic, strange attractor, where all of these things are going on simultaneously. You know, ready, fire, aim is how we program, and there are methodologies that espouse starting with the testing and then doing the coding and then doing the design. You know, I think that's one of the extreme programming tenets. Right now, when I look at that, since this is talk is Camelot number 6, I'm thinking about Perl 6. I'm thinking that in actual fact, Perls 1 through 5 were a prototype for Perl 6. And, you know, you plan to throw away a prototype. So now Unix has an interesting history. I think down here, this is a little dance being done by BSD and Linux. The C family tree kind of looks like this. We originally had K and R C to begin with, and then we had gazillion different kinds of C's, and then we brought that back together to ANSI C, and then something happened. And then something else happened. Then something else happened, and this is the Microsoft view of reality. Okay. Here's the Perl family tree. Actually, this is slightly disingenuous here, because there was a little branch off to the side here when ActiveState first ported Perl to the Windows platform, but we made a big effort and pulled it back together. So the line got a little wider there, and then it got narrow again. The nice thing about open source is you can pull the stuff back together if you feel you really need to. But you know, this slide is set under construction down there since the beginning, and it still says that. That's fine. Here's the other way of looking at the Perl family tree. This, needless to say, this is sort of notional, but you knew that. Now, Perl's design from the beginning, since my background is both in linguistics and computer science, a little of each. Perl has a lot of linguistics notions in it, not on the level of COBOL, where it just sort of looks like English, but at a much deeper level. With a natural language, you learn it once and you use it many times, hopefully. So, you know, you should optimize for expressiveness, not for learnability. I wish somebody had told that to the... I think somebody told that to the Japanese before they designed their language. I wish their language was a little easier for me to learn. But anyway, the other thing about language is that you kind of learn as you go, and many acceptable levels of competence are acceptable. What that means is we don't expect a 5-year-old to speak with the same subset of the language as a 50-year-old or a 46-year-old. It's perfectly okay for a kid to use kid talk and a baby to use baby talk. And contrast that with your typical C++ shop, where if you don't know the whole language, if you program like in the C subset of C++, you sort of get laughed out of the office. And that, to me, it should be acceptable to program in Perl subsets. If you want to program in a subset that looks like Sid or Awk or C, that's fine. Or the subset that looks like Python. Some of you are awake. There's a lot of other things here that I'm not going to go through. There's actually an expansion of most of these points on my website if you want to go and see more of them. But there really are a lot of things in Perl that are based on how we use natural language. And, I don't want to lose that as we go forward into continuing to evolve Perl. Now, for more recent history, meaning 5 years ago, plus or minus, when Perl 5 first came out, this was the what we announced as the goals of Perl 5. And Perl 5 did improve in all of these areas. But as I look back at it now, in all of these areas, it can continue to improve. So most of the rest of this talk is going to be about that. Now, Perl 5 had some constraints on its design. First of all was the need for backward compatibility. We have deprecated a few things along the way, but most of them were what I call eternally deprecated, meaning don't do that, but it still works. So most of your Perl 1 scripts, I'm sure you've all written Perl 1 scripts, right? Some of you weren't born yet. They still work in Perl 5 for the most part. You might get some warnings, but we had to keep the backward compatibility at that level at that point. Of course, another constraint on the design of Perl 5 was my own idiocy, because Perl 5 was the last time I redesigned the language more or less by myself, and so it was limited by my own imagination. The cultural model of Perl 5, it worked for Perl 5, but it has bottlenecks in it in terms of how we develop have developed Perl 5, having a one person sort of in charge of all the integration tends to be a bottleneck. Stop that. And of course, I was ignorant of the future. In fact, there were places where I was ignorant of the present and of the past. But we'll let that one go. Lack of round to it. Another way in which the Perl 5 was constrained was in trying to deal with all the other things there, was that the core was actually quite complex in order to do many of the things. You like it when Perl, really rips through a file really quickly doing pattern matching or whatever you're doing, but a lot of that is because of the incestuous nature of the internals and doing all sorts of weird optimizations underneath. So it's a little hard to get in there and actually to change it, particularly if you're starting out. There aren't that many people who can do it, and that also limits how much Perl 5 can evolve. And of course, there's the issue of complacency. You can easily sit there and say, "Well, it's good enough," but that sort of was starting to happen. Between version 5.0 5, and I should say 5.6, since we changed the version numbering system to be more regular here. It took about 2 years. And there are many reasons for that. Some of them that I mentioned in the last slide. Some personal reasons here was that I was busy writing the new Camel book, Camel 3, as we call it. I was busy with the doing the Pearl Whirl cruise. There's a Linux Linux. What do they call it? Linux Lunacy, something like that. Cruise coming up. I highly recommend it. I actually, if you can afford it, and it's cheaper than you'd think because the cruise lines have actually overbuilt. So they're trying to get people to go on all these cruises. I was expecting the Pearl cruise to, you know, be all these old fogies who were pretending to be Pearl programmers, but it actually was people who were much of the same demographics as you. And we had a good conference there. I spent a good part of it proofing the Camel book from my cabin. You know, you look up every 5 minutes and there's another beautiful view. Oh, that's nice. Go back to proofing. I've really been busy. After that, I was busy getting ready for yet another Pearl conference, 19-100. That's what they called it. And after that, getting ready for the Pearl conference 4.0. And we had, as much as a year before the Pearl conference, we had said to ourselves, you know, we ought to have some sort of a constitutional convention and figure out how to reorganize the Pearl community to be more effective. And yeah, that was a great idea. And we finally, at this last summer, we said, well, Chip Salzenberg said, let's have one of those meetings. So we had that. We started having that, and an interesting thing happened. We spent the first hour or so, gabbing about all sorts of political and organizational issues of fairly boring, mundane nature. And partway through, John Orwant comes in and stands there for a few minutes listening, and then he very calmly walks over to the coffee service table in this room, and there were about 20 of us in this room, and he picks up a mug and throws it against the other wall. And he keeps throwing mugs against the other wall. And he says, "We are fucked. Unless we can come up with something that will excite the Pearl community, because everyone's just getting bored and going off doing other things." And he was right. His motivation was perhaps, maybe he wanted the Pearl conferences to get bigger, or maybe he likes Pearl doing well or something like that. But in actual fact, he was right. And so that sort of galvanized the meeting, and we actually sat back, and he said, "I don't care what you do, but you got to do something big." So, and then he went away. Don't misunderstand me. I mean, this was the most perfectly planned tantrum you have ever seen. I mean, if any of you who know John, he likes control, and this is a perfectly controlled tantrum. It was amazing to see. I was thinking, now should I get up and throw mugs too? I don't know. So we started talking after that, and the idea popped up, actually, I don't remember if I said it or who did, that maybe we ought to rewrite Pearl. And the thought that occurred to me right then was that we had some new technology. Pearl has a decompiler now, You can take a Perl 5 script and compile out. You compile it down to the bytecode, and you can take that and compile it back to Perl 5 code. Well, if you can compile it back to Perl 5 code, why not compile it back to Perl 6 code? Well, okay. And we could even arrange to keep the comments, or with that realization, suddenly, okay, we are now free to actually do a major redesign here and think what can we do that we would have done differently, had we known better 14 years ago. So later that day, we also had a meeting of the Perl Porters, which was an open meeting of about 50 people there, and we started handing out tasks about how we would redesign. And then the next day, I announced in my keynote at the Perl conference that we were rewriting Perl. I got about 3 hours of sleep that night because I was rewriting my speech. That would have been okay, except that I only had 3 hours the night before. So if you guys listen to the on audio on the net, you'll hear me being very spaced out, more than usual. So Perl 6. As I was flying on the airplane here on Delta Airlines, the monitor up here was showing all these pictures, and it had these sayings up there, and it said, "If you can dream it, you can do it." Walt Disney. Now, this is actually false. I think that Walt was confused between necessary and sufficient conditions. If you don't dream it, you can't do it. That is certainly accurate. So we've been dreaming. And so everything is fair game. We are thinking how to reinvent the Lexer, the parser, the interpreter, the code generators, the internal APIs, the external APIs, the language itself, and the culture surrounding it. And interestingly, the first thing we started reinventing was the culture. Here are some mailing lists that have sprung up since August 1st, and a rough idea of the number of messages that have been posted to each of those. These correspond to various working groups, and we have a new working group model where there's an official person in charge of each working group. Each working group has a charter. They sort of have sunset law that says we will get done by such and so and shut ourselves down unless we can justify continuing our existence. So it's not, we're doing something very different here than the Perl 5 porters mailing list that just existed forever. It wasn't really even about porting all that much anymore. And there's a lot more sense of responsibility. People are holding each other accountable. And it's been working out great so far. And the amount of raw flameage has been much less than in the olden days. So far, so good on the culture. And we'll continue evolving the culture. But you can see from this that some of these working groups are quite general. Perl 6 language. Obviously, it has a lot of activity. And will probably go on for a good long time. Some of these were working groups set up to discuss one little issue, one RFC. Sometimes the timing was a little off. If you look at the language unlink one here, they created the mailing list just as the discussion was dying. So it never got anything in it. But this tells you some of the ways we're breaking down the culture here. In particular, there's an official way of announcing RFCs. We're splitting the language issues from the internals issues. build issues are being covered, QA issues. Notice that says Perl QA because the hope in that group is that we will back apply some of the QA things we developed for Perl 6 back into Perl 5. Now, one thing I want to make clear about all this Perl 6 activity is that we are not abandoning Perl 5 anytime soon. We don't know how long this Perl 6 thing is going to take. And, you know, there's still people out there using Perl 4. So we expect Perl 5 will need support for a good long time, and we plan to give it. Anyway, probably enough of that one. Now, Perl 6 has a different set of constraints. First of all, hopefully these are more liberal constraints than Perl 5 had. It still is the case that Larry needs to understand Perl 6. For some strange reason, even though they've split out into all these working groups and even have a language working group, they appointed me the chief language designer. So I said, okay. That means I need to kind of make sure I grok everything that's out there. That doesn't mean I have to come up with it in the first place. It doesn't mean that I actually have to understand how to do it, only how it interacts with other things. Other constraints that we're putting on the design, you can propose a new feature, but if it's not something that people really need, we're not going to put it in. The underlying philosophy of Perl is to serve. And if it doesn't serve our needs, then what good is it? Can we implement it efficiently and robustly? And a biggie here is, does it preclude translation from Perl 5? We need to be able to have a migration path from Perl 5 to Perl 6. So if you distort the semantics too violently, then it becomes very difficult to translate. So Perl 5 will, Perl 6 will bear quite a close resemblance in many ways to Perl 5. Does the utility of the change grow faster than the complexity? Does the size of the executable grow slower than Moore's law? You know, it's going to grow a little. These things always grow over time. But is the computer getting faster? We have to make sure that we take the time to maintain Perl 5, as we mentioned. And we also need to make sure that we take the time to design it right. You know, they say there's never time to do it right, but there's always time to do it over. Well, we want to do it over first, or something like that. The RFC process. We call them RFCs, and we really do mean requests for comment. They're not standards. There are currently 361 RFCs. They're written in simple, plain old document format. They must be well-formed to be accepted to the announced RFC list and posted on dev.perl.org. They're subject to revision, retraction, freezing. The first one came out right after the Perl conference on August 1st, and we had had it open for brainstorm essentially until the end of last month. So that's when I got to take a snapshot of it. And the theory was that in 2 weeks, I would read all of these RFCs and come up with a language design. Right. I have read the abstracts. I've read many of them completely. I've read the abstracts of all of them but the last 50. So, you know, run out of things to say here, all I'll do is just read the last 50 and you can see how I do this, sort of a master class approach here or something. Now, the hand-wiping requirements. These are things that will be in Perl 6, and for some definition or other, but they're rather nebulous. Perl needs to support higher-level programming, and I'll go into some of these things more as we go on. And it must support lower-level programming. It'd be nice if it supported more paradigms, the P word. We really want it to avoid the equivalent of DLL hell. It's getting harder and harder with all these modules out on CPAN and different versions of them to keep them all straight. And there's ways of handling that sort of thing. We're going to do it. Perl must support absolute flexibility. Well, there's actually an RFC that says Perl 6 is the last version of Perl. By which they mean we'll do it good enough that there will be no need for a Perl 7. In fact, they say that the version number will asymptotically approach pi times 2. That's what the RFC says. I haven't said whether it's right or not yet. It needs to have a mean and lean core, we'll talk about that. Perl must not surprise people unnecessarily. And there are still ways in which Perl surprises people, and we can reduce some of that. It needs to be as simple as possible, but no simpler. It needs to map well onto your program, onto your problem. The better your solution space maps onto your problem space, the more compact your solution will be. And Perl must remain Perl. There's an RFC that says that, too. Now, there's a lot of things we can actually simplify in Perl, in Perl 5, going to Perl 6. And we're going to try and do a lot of these things here. If the core is going to be lean and mean, that implies that a lot of stuff is going to move out of the core. Any non-critical built-ins, socket calls, various operating system interfaces, things like that, can be moved out to modules. Now, maybe they'll get auto-loaded transparently so they'll look like they're in the core, but there's no reason that they actually have to be there to begin with. So we can sort of discount those in the internals design. Provided, of course, that calling out to those modules is efficient. So that's another goal. All variables will be usable as objects. So there are ways in which you would like to be able to treat arrays and hashes and scalars as objects. So for instance, this comes back to the category of not surprising people. People expect length to work on arrays. Well, that's because they're actually thinking of the array there as an object, not as a list in a scalar context. So probably length is going to become a method on the array object. That means the translator from Perl 5 would actually have to, if it says length of array, that means something is probably a mistake, but we'll probably translate the mistake. In any event, all the variables are actually objects internally, rather than having all these funny conditional code like Perl 5 has in it. Everything will be run off of vtables, like C++ does. That does not necessarily imply that we're writing it in C++. Probably not. But that's the implementation. And that will be very efficient, and it will allow alternate implementations to be swapped in and out very quickly and loaded in as modules. Now, many of the strange global variables that you all love dearly can be lexically scoped, and that will simplify things like multi-threading. File handles become objects using object-oriented notation, meaning we've pretty much decided that they'll be regular scalar variables as you do object-oriented program right now in Perl, rather than the bare file names. And this simplifies a whole bunch of things. Among other things, we can simplify the parsing rules for indirect objects, and we can probably simplify the parsing rules in other places, the disambiguation rules. And we might even go, pretty wild there in terms of how you specify a slice might be entirely different. As long as we can translate it. We plan to unconfuse homonyms like the different kinds of do, the different kinds of eval, because those trip people up. For instance, eval block is probably going to become try block, since that seems to be the way most other languages are going these days, and that's what eval block means. So we may disambiguate that way. Type globs, we would very much like to go away. Excess, we would dearly love to go away. I think we can do that if we can make Perl a low enough level language to specify the interfaces. I kind of had this realization when several years ago when I wrote a thing called JPL, Java Perl Lingo, and we linked Java and Perl into the same executable and called back and forth between them. I realized that Java had sufficient information to write all the glue to call back and forth between Java and Perl, and there was no need to have a glue language. And I thought, that's cool. I wish Perl could do that. So part of the design of Perl will be that you can specify enough type information in your function, your method signatures, to be able to do that, to be able to produce that glue automatically. We're going to be standardizing the way objects are set up. Not that we're going to be undoing all the flexibility that you have right now, but we will have some standard ways that will be very efficient and more. It'll be easier. Okay, Perl 5. By design, tried to make it easy to use objects, but did not try to make it easy to write object classes. And we'd like to make it easier to write object classes. That's what I'm trying to say. It's becoming more apparent that we need a real garbage collector, either one of our own, or we need to be able to relate with one that is supplied. For instance, if we compile Perl down to the C-sharp virtual machine, it supplies its own garbage collector, and we have to be able to deal with that. Exception handling becomes completely object-oriented. You can still pretend like it's string-oriented. If you die with a message, you can still treat it like a string, but in actual fact, it's an object. That gives us many benefits. We will be able to hopefully have easier ways to interpolate expressions in strings, and might even think, I haven't thought about this a lot, that's why the question mark on the end, about simplifying the precedence levels. The translator should be able to handle that if it knows what the precedence of the respective expressions is. If it needs to put parens, then it can, or whatever. So we might be able to do that. Now the question is, with all the simplification going on, how much can we get back out? That's a good question. I don't know the answer. We can handle a certain amount of complexity as long as we hide it from people. As long as you're not exposed to the part of the complexity that you're not interested in at the moment, then it doesn't hurt you. It goes back to programming in a subset of Perl. If the standard Perl has a certain level of complexity, and if you say this declaration at the top of the thing, then you get this whole new level of complexity, but if you don't say that, you don't have to worry about it. So there's things you can do about the complexity. Now let's actually look at some of these RFCs. As I say, there are lots of them. I've actually sorted out the first 20 of these, and I said I've read all but about the last 50 of them. So you see some very interesting things here. And I can see I'm not going to have time to read them all to you. Darn. But anyway, just to let you know what the way I'm going through these is, let me just show you one for instance here. Here's one that probably won't be done, but let's have a look at it. That's hard to read, isn't it? Let's look at it. What number was that? Number 9. Yeah. Oh, that's because I already classified it. Okay, let's talk about my classification scheme here. As you see, there's the 361, all except for the first 20. Those first 20 have already disappeared into some of these subdirectories here. Now, you can't see it, but that one says bad, and that one says good, and that one says ugly. So I really am sorting them into the good, the bad, and the ugly. There's also a culture, things that I don't want to deal with yet. There's things to dealing with culture, internals, there's retracted ones, and there's things dealing with metasyntax. So if we look down into the good directory here, in addition to classifying them with good, bad, and ugly, I'm also giving them grades. Not because I want to flunk anybody, but because I just want to be able to kind of sort them in order. And the two grades I'm giving them are on, the first grade is this a real problem that we really need to deal with? And the second grade letter there is, how well is the solution specified? And a lot of these things, you know, are frank, and they say, you know, I don't know how to solve this. That's fine. These should not be taken as castigating people for brainstorming. But it doesn't mean I can kind of look at them in sort of decreasing order here. So if I look at all the ones here, it'd be great to have higher resolution time values, and I think they ought to be done in floating point. And the next one, and some of these I've actually gone through and I put little notes up to myself up there as I go through. You know, should we modify open to support file objects and extensibility? Yes. there's a few things that are left out here, but I think that open should return, rather than having a file handle as the first argument, it should return the file handle object. And all well and good. Rename the local operator. Yeah, I think we ought to do that. It doesn't really mean local. It confuses people to call it local. The problem, of course, you know, notice this is a B solution. It's not a perfect solution because they have not, in fact, come up with the right name yet, probably. There are many candidates here. Save temp, save temp, temp save, scope temp, current, scratch pad, deliver, preserve, save L. Consideration for me is that how it's used grammatically. It will often be used with an hour declaration, and so it depends on whether it's going to come before or after the hour declaration. If it comes after, you'd say, hour temporary dollar foo equals whatever. But if it came before, you'd have to say, temporarily, our dollar foo equals whatever. So, anyway, linguistics is fun. Here's one that yes, we do need to reorganize all the funny variables. But rather than putting them to other globals, they need to be object-oriented to the extent possible. And here's one that's definitely is rated BF, so it's pretty good problem, lousy solution. And that is that there needs to be ways of tailoring error messages, and we have to do that anyway for internationalization, probably, or localization rather. So fine. Here's some of the things in the bad directory. Let's see. Variable used only once, possible type will should be replaced with warnings on uses of uninitialized variables, and then they want us to solve the halting problem. So, no. Highlander variable types. This is an interesting one, and it's tempting. The notion is that you combine that if you are talking about an array, that is really a funny name for a reference from the correspondingly named scalar. And that makes some interesting ramifications, but I think it would probably be more confusing in the long run for most people. Multi-line comments in Perl. I'm sorry, I was brainwashed by the Ada rationale, and Ada has comments to the end of the line. And I think if your editor can't put a row of sharps down the left, then you need a better editor. and so on. Ugly things are ones that, yeah, they're sort of good ideas, but maybe we need to think about them. We need to talk a lot about threads, but let's see. Immediate subroutines. Yeah, we need ways of having subroutines that are evaluated at compile time. But this mechanism is probably not it. Lexical variables made default. No. let's see. This one is keep default Perl free of constraints such as warnings or strict. Well, yeah. I can argue this one both ways, too. Overloadable logic operators. This has ramifications on a semantic level because at least currently the Perl internals don't distinguish between these funny C-like ampersand or and that the higher logical operators and the if then else's and the if and unless modifiers, those all compile down to the same thing internally. So it would be kind of funny to make some of them behave one way and some of them behave another. So that's something that we really have to think about hard. But it's possible that we might allow it if you declare that you want it that way. You know, so. Next one. This is too ugly. this is something to do with using pod documentation for specifying test cases and stuff. But anyway, that's kind of how I've been going through it, and they're great fun. You should read through them if you want to be entertained. They're all over the map. Many of them contradict others. There's no way we're going to implement them all because they are self-contradictory. In fact, some people have written their own contradictory RFCs. They say, well, do it this way. No, do it this way. Yeah, I was going to point out Brad here. In fact, let's see here if I can find this. No, not that way. Not that way either. Theoretically, I can do a search for license. Let's see. Artistic license must be changed. It's fair enough. Yeah. Perl 6's license should be a minor bug fix of Perl 5's license. That's one of Brad's.
I retracted that.
Yeah, he retracted it. I didn't show you the retracted ones. Some of those are really fun. Artistic license must be changed. Perl 6, this is his other one. Perl 6's license should be GPL Artistic 2.0, which is a complete rewrite of the first artistic license. But that's great, too. I actually haven't looked at that issue very closely, so I can't tell you whether I'm going to bless that or not. But I think it probably is a good idea. Anyway. No, I haven't got that far. okay. Other than all these other categories we talked about, one big category in my mind is things I don't want to think about yet. I'm deferring this one. In actual fact, licensing is probably one of the things that we can think about for a good long time yet, at least until we start publishing alphas. Now, Perl is a low-level language. Polymorphism is your enemy if you're trying to do low-level programming. You want to get early compile-time binding of as much stuff as possible. You want the compiler to be able to spit out really efficient code. So if you write a loop and declare your variable as an int and you tell it spit out C code, by golly, you want that to be an int at the C code. Similarly, for num is shorthand for a double by default. Str is a string. For some reason, they're all coming out to three letters. But you'll be able to get nice declarations like this: my num pi, it's a constant and its value is whatever pi is. Similarly, if you have homogeneous arrays or hashes, you'd like to be able to declare the type of all of the elements in it. And you'd like that to take up compact storage. And that'll be a whole lot more efficient than the way arrays and hashes are currently stored. Furthermore, you could not only specify what the types are, but maybe even give hints to the compiler about I'm only going to use 4 bits, so if you want to pack them in there really tight, go ahead. If you want to have mathematically compact arrays, multidimensional, then we'll have some way of declaring those. And there's a whole series of RFCs about what the mathematicians want out of Perl. And we can give it to them. We may make them declare up the top, use funny mathematically oriented arrays or something like that, but we have ways of doing that. Non-homogeneous arrays, I think, are going to be done primarily through the object interface, and kind of like to borrow the notion of unsafe code from C#, where you can go in there and do things to low-level pointers. As long as you're careful. By way of contrast, if Perl is going to become a more high-level language, then polymorphism is your friend. You want to delay your binding as long as possible to what implements what. And Perl has always been in the business of allowing but not requiring abstraction, so that fits right in. We'd like to put in more support for functional programming, more support for logic programming, more support, in particular, for what I'd call little languages. Particularly the folks at Bell Labs invented this notion that they invented it shortly after they invented Yak. That, hey, Yak is cool. You can write a grammar for a little language. And so all these little itty-bitty languages sprung up that were all for one purpose. And then, you know, anytime you had to write a new program, you wrote this new little language to program the program. And it was all neat and cool, except that you had to learn a little new language every time. And it was always different. What we'd like to explore is the notion of using a big language as a little language. If it's okay to program in Perl subsets, can you define a Perl subset that looks like a little language? And how do you get around paying the price of the generality of the big language? And we have ways of thinking about that. In particular, I'll get to that. Perl 4's approach to high-level programming or meta-syntax was the eval operator. It's sort of what you had. And maybe type club assignment if you were really lucky and didn't smile wrong. Perl 5's approach to meta-syntax was much more general. Not only does it have the eval operator, it has begin blocks, which are very powerful. The whole notion that you can run the interpreter at compile time and do whatever you jolly well please. Well, up to a point. But by that means, Perl 5 implemented importation is in a completely general fashion. And it allows overriding and overloading of certain built-ins on the fly as you're compiling. And there was the concept of source filtering, that if you declare a source filter at some point, you can completely change the language from there on down. There's a filter that's used Python-esque. There's a filter by Damien Conway called Lingua Romana Perlingata, which lets you program Perl in Latin. I kid you not. If you ever get to hear that talk by Damien, in fact, if you ever get to hear any talk by Damien, go to it. One of the RFCs that's out there is another of Damien's talks where he proposes adding quantum mechanical operators, which will do quantum superpositions. Seriously, he's proposing this in case, you know, someday we get quantum computers. Actually, it has some notational convenience because he has any and all operators that work interestingly as quantifiers. But anyway, Perl 6. Not only do we have all the Perl 5 approaches, but we'd like to be able to say, we keep getting asked, well, we need to have some sort of a site-wide configuration file that Perl will run when we start up. Well, no, if it is going to be implicit. But if you are willing at the beginning of your site's Perl scripts to say something like use policy, then you can have your site policy in one file, and that file could then in turn use all the other, you know, turn all strictures or whatever, you know, set everything up the way you want. As long as you declare that, then it's sort of a meta declaration of all the other things you're going to use. So that would be a nice thing to have. I intend that the lexer and parser of Perl 6 be written in Perl, not in C. Perl's low-levelness needs to be made efficient enough so that the lexer and parser written in Perl will be fast enough. The lexer should be written with Perl regular expressions. The parser, if we can get away with it, I'd like to do a recursive descent parser because it can do much better error diagnostics, and we can easily do the last point, and that is add new lexer or parser rules on the fly. And, you know, the problem with the source filtering was that it was all or nothing. You know, you could filter the text as it came through, but then if you wanted to just tweak the Perl code that was coming through, you had to parse the Perl on the fly. This lets you use the Perl parser for what it's good at and then tweak it at whatever level you want. So any place where the lexer or parser is recognizing something, we will have a hook which says, you can redefine, you know, how you recognize numbers, how you recognize strings, how you recognize quoted constructs, bracketed constructs, like subscripts, operators, functions, expressions, blocks, lists of blocks, like try, catch, finally, subroutine definitions, and complete compilation units. So that ought to give us enough flexibility to evolve a little further for a while. Now, if you can redefine operators, then why not have Unicode operators? Some of you are squeamish about that. Well, I say why not? The mechanism will be abused, so what? There's a billion mathematicians out there who are always inventing their own notation, and I'd rather actually have them use it, one or two. They're going to write a program. They want one or two mathematical operators. They'd like to write their script in terms of it. Fine. Why not let them? They can redefine their own operator, but it's going to be, some sort of what I like to call a swearing operator. If you limit yourself to ASCII, all you do is make longer and longer operators that look weirder and weirder. So let's use some of the symbols we're going to have available with Unicode. One of the things I like about Tickle is that it has always had a model of semantic delegation, where the first verb in the command, can be kind of agnostic as to the meaning of the rest of the statement. It just hands it off to the next level, and then that can figure out what the next level means. This ties back in with being able to define little languages. And so that's another good use for having these hooks, medicine tactic hooks. that also indicates that we're not just doing macro processing here. We're not rewriting text. We're actually thinking about putting the hooks on the level where you can tweak the semantics, not just at the textual level. Metasyntactic warpage like this will be lexically scoped. So no magic action. If I declare use this funny looking Perl code from here down to the end of the file, that's where it is. It's not off in some other file. It doesn't change the meaning of somebody else's file. If you want to do it in the other file, you got to declare it there too. So that limits the scope. A lot of stuff in Perl, the design of Perl all along has been, how do you limit the scope of complexity? The logic programming is if you want to do backtracking, it's limited inside a regular expression. Limiting the complexity is important. And to me, anything is fair as long as you pre-declare, even rewriting Perl in Latin. It's crazy, but it's fair. I think that's okay. Things we must do, we must manage the documentation well so that if people want to chase down that complexity, they look at this new thing and they see the declaration at the top. Yeah, it says use this funny syntactic module. Okay, how do they find the documentation for that easily? Got to make sure that's there. And we have to manage the warpage on the semantic level, where there are interactions between modules. And there's other subjects we could talk about, but we're basically out of time. So I'd like to leave you with something my screensaver popped up earlier today. It says, never promise to complete a project within 6 months of the end of the year in either direction. So we won't. I don't know how long we can go here, but I'll be quite glad to take questions. I presume when they turned down the lights, that was because that was a subtle hint. My current leaning is I really like the new iThreads model. because I think it simplifies the way you can think about it. For those of you who are not aware, there's two threading models in Perl 5. One is more of your standard threading model called pthreads, where everything is shared more or less by default. And that has advantages in terms of efficiency, but not as much as you'd think. There's a new iThread model, which is more like a fork inside the process, where it takes and actually forks your interpreter. That could be inefficient, but I think if we do some of the things we're thinking about doing with copy-on-write semantics, then it will not be as inefficient as all that, and to clone a new thread. And I think that it's in some ways it's much safer to assume that all your global variables are not shared, and specifically declare the things you do want to share and how you want to share them. So that's my leanings, but I suspect both models will be there, up to and including sharing everything. So. Oh, you're too obvious. What we will probably, the question is, what languages are we considering for writing Perl 6 in? Well, and as I said, the Luxor and Parser I want to write in Perl. Now, I am under no illusions that we can write the runtime system in Perl, especially for the interpreter. I mean, just that would be silly. I think at the moment what we're leaning toward is writing it in C, but with some amount of pre-processing of our own devising, which manages some of the things that you know, maybe we're reinventing some of C++, but we are not there's not a great deal of there's some interest in the Perl community in using C++, but not that much. Well, there's Bradley says there's some interest in using in Java. Well, yeah, there is. And let me say that we're actually specifically thinking about targeting not just a C backend, but also a Java backend and a C# backend, and not just trying to slap it on the side afterwards, because that doesn't work. But thinking in the design how we divide up the opcodes such that they map nicely onto these other virtual machines, as well as onto a more C-ish thing. Which garbage collection methods are we looking into? That's one of those things that we're kind of deferring on purpose. We currently, if you're not aware, currently Perl uses a reference counting method, which has some nice features and some not so nice features. But there's a number of different garbage collection algorithms out there which have different features. Anything from your basic mark and sweep to various kind of generational and various hybrid approaches. What we're hoping is that we can keep the interface generic enough that we can plug different garbage collectors in. And this goes along with having our own preprocessor, so that we can, part of the reason for having the preprocessor have our own language is that we can, if we can write it generically enough that we could preprocess it into C or into Java or into these other things, but that also means hopefully we can preprocess it into handling whatever garbage collector that virtual machine wanted. And some virtual machines specify their own garbage collector and some don't. Okay. That's it. the question is, what do I want to say about XML and Unicode? which this slide said. Well, we've had XML support and Unicode support in one way or another in Perl for some time now. And the XML support is pretty heavily used. There's been an XML mailing list for a couple of years now, I guess. And there's lots of XML modules for Perl. Some of them work better than others. There's talk about ways that we can make them work better. In some ways, there's a bit of an impedance mismatch between XML and Perl. So if you take a parser written in C and hook it up to Perl, and you end up building up all these object hierarchies, it ends up using a lot of memory and runs real slow. But part of what I didn't go into there on the object design was if there are standard ways of mapping what look like Perl objects onto low-level C-style objects to where you could quickly load them in a very compact way in the way C or C++ would do, then you could speed up things like XML parsers. On Unicode, Unicode is required to support XML correctly, and Perl 5.6 actually supports Unicode for some definition of supports. But the story on Unicode is basically Perl's model of characters is going to be Unicode based. So even if there are different encodings floating around inside Perl, in the abstract, you look at a character and it's got a particular character number and it has a length of 1, regardless of how it's encoded. We carry that abstraction completely through the language itself. And the only place you actually have to worry about what the real encoding is in the interfaces to the outside world or to older Perl modules that are making assumptions about bytes. We've got a pretty good migration path set out on that. And in actual fact, it's pretty much there for Perl 5.6. And we plan to just do better with Perl 6. We plan to back up. Perl 5 characters are always encoded internally in UTF-8 or in bytes, and it keeps track of which it is for you. Perl 6 will allow more, since we have the VTable approach to the objects, we can have different encodings and mix and match. And this gives us a great deal of scalability, flexibility. Suppose you want to shoehorn Perl into your Palm Pilot or your TV set, whatever box is on top of it. Then you probably say there is only one internal format for strings. Maybe it's UTF-8. Anything comes out in another form, you always just translate it. Just boom. Maybe that's not terribly efficient. On the other hand, a great big server pulling in all sorts of different stuff might have encodings going around both in UTF-8, might have UTF-16, might have UTF-32, might have just arrays of integers, various ways of, you might have big five, might have shift-gis, whatever. All the stuff floating around in there, and then if you have to convert, you do it lazily to whatever you need. If you really want everything to be fast, you write a complete crossbar where you can translate anything directly to anything else. That's a lot of work. But it'll run really fast, and it'll be really big. But, hey, Moore's Law is on our side. But you get that scalability where you can make the choice of trading off more implementation for speed. That's the direction we're headed with Unicode. We need to wind it up. Is maybe one more question? Yeah.
C# a couple of times. One of the directions that Microsoft can go with it is make it very
Yes. That's a very good question. I don't know the answer, but if it's, you know, I can tell you my basic philosophy on all these things. I'd like to have my cake and eat it too. So, if somebody, yes, I mean, the component models are very important for a lot of people, and I think they ought to be supported. And I don't know what to tell you on that. Certainly, ActiveState has already been working with hooking the Perl 5 into the component models on Windows. But if we can program down to the C# engine, then essentially we get the integration for free, I think. Okay. Thank you very much.